Hey, everybody, it's Devin.
And Kate, somehow.
Welcome to Med Crimes. Somehow?
Yes, okay.
Do you not know who you are?
I know who I am. It's just been an evening, and Devin and I just spent a half an hour chatting about life before we finally hit the record button because we can't get anything done when we're around each other. It's a whole vibe. And also,
had to catch up.
My head hurts now because my four-year-old son hit me in the face with a dog toy, and my eye is swollen, and that's my feelings. Thank you.
My head hurts because I realized at about 4:30 this afternoon that I didn't have a cup of coffee this morning.
Whoa, you stumbled over the word coffee. That's
hence to show that I really needed that cup of coffee, but I didn't have it at 4:30.
That's a huge bummer for you.
I'm on caffeine. Here we go. Caffeine withdrawal.
Okay.
I hope everyone had a nice Thanksgiving.
Me too.
This must be Giving Tuesday.
Is Happy, it?
Isn't that the Tuesday after Thanksgiving?
I didn't know that was a thing.
There's Black Friday, Plaid Saturday.
Whoa. I don't know any
Cyber
of this.
Monday, Giving
Tuesday. I know
Cyber Tuesday.
Monday because I buy things on Cyber Monday.
I think it's Giving Tuesday.
Okay.
So give to someone.
All right.
That's my holiday message.
I love that. Great. Well, we're happy to be back with you guys. It's been a crazy ride. We've got a couple of new Patreons.
Welcome to the family. Roxy Aberly, welcome.
Oh, God, these names. Every time we do this, the names get better.
You're challenging us.
I feel like Roxy Aberly is definitely like some kind of old-timey like lounge singer. I kind of love that for you.
With like the really long cigarette. Unlike the cigarette holders.
She's a lounge singer. She doesn't smoke. She just breathes in the secondhand smoke of everybody else.
Got it. That's good for the voice.
Shelly McKeon.
Welcome, Shelly.
You guys are both sexy little fairies jumping around in the grass.
Nice.
Yep.
We're going to jump right into it because Kate says it's going to be a long one.
It might. I don't think it's going to be crazy long, but it might take a little bit of time because holy Jolly Jane Toppin.
Jolly Jane.
Y'all want to know what she did?
Can we have a brief recap of part one?
We sure can.
A snippet.
We sure can. So, Jolly Jane Toppin had a very rough childhood, and the effects of which manifested in her adulthood, like, pretty hard. She lived and worked as an indentured servant and then moved into nursing school after that. When she was asked to leave nursing school, actually, after a bunch of suspicious deaths kind of rose, and she had illnesses among a bunch of her patients, and it sounds like she was taking pleasure in mixing different like medications and chemicals together to sort of experiment on what that would do to patients. And in the process of doing that, she harmed and killed a bunch of people.
And I think we ended where she killed her pretty much sister.
Yeah.
And then went back for her watch.
Exactly. So when she didn't have a ton of strange patients at her disposal, she moved to friends, family members, and people she knew. And she had weaseled her way into becoming a respected private nurse when she killed her stepsister that she literally grew up with by poisoning her with strychnine.
Which you had to tell me what it was because I didn't have a clue.
Yes,
but it was
right.
Rat poison.
Yeah, essentially. Yeah. And trigger warning for this episode as well. We are going to be talking about some themes of sexual assault. There's suicide mentioned in this episode and also abuse of different kinds. So I'll give you a little heads up when we're getting into those themes. So it is now August of 1899. She has just poisoned her stepsister, Elizabeth.
Stolen her watch.
Stolen her fucking gold watch. And Jane later admitted that she got much more of an intense sexual thrill from poisoning those close to her.
Wait, sexual?
Yes. So remember in the first episode, we mentioned that there was one woman who survived the ordeal and her encounter with Jane.
Yes.
And what she had done was poison her with morphine, and she was able to resist taking more from Jane. And because of that, it probably saved her life. Mm-hmm. And she remembered Jane touching her.
Everybody thought she was delusional.
Her. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it did come sort of clarify to her in later years when all of this came out that, oh my God, that was Jane. And she did really do that to me.
Oh.
So there was some sexual motivation here with her crimes, believe it or not. So, this motivated her to kind of focus more of her attentions on people that she had some kind of a relationship with, like either a friendship or an acquaintance or even a close relationship, because that made the whole process a lot more exciting for her. So clearly she's
that's very where she gets disturbed, her thrill.
Very yeah. disturbed, very evil individual. So 40-year-old Myra Connors was a
I love that name.
Myra.
Myra.
That's pretty, isn't it? 40-year-old Myra Connors was a dining matron at St. John's Theological School in Cambridge. She made good money, and this position was actually like a very well-respected position. She was sort of like the head of all dining services for this nice. Boarding school.
Nice.
And so this came with a lot of like social stature, apparently, back in the day. And also...
Well, because, yeah, everything's about high society stuff.
It
yeah.
is, and this was like a very fancy school. Apparently.
Okay.
And so this position actually came with like a nice apartment and a servant
Whoa.
That was like totally included in like
I want to be a dining matron.
Me too. So fucking sign me up. That sounds amazing. So she got this nice apartment, right, with a maid. And then in February of 1900, Myra called her good friend Jane Toppin for assistance one night. The two right. knew each other. Because she was having stomach pains. Now, she had been to the doctor earlier that day, and the doctor had diagnosed her with localized peritonitis. Essentially, that's like the inflammation of part of the peritoneum, which is that membrane that protects our internal organs. These days, we would treat that with antibiotics and sometimes surgery. But at the time, her doctor had prescribed her powdered opium and arrowroot for the pain. Arrowroot was actually a really popular Victorian era supplement, essentially. They actually still have it and sell it in stores. And it's used for like common GI ailments like diarrhea, constipation, mm-hmm. things like that. Doesn't do much for the underlying cause. But Jane later admitted that Myra became her next target. And at this time, she wanted to take a lot more from Myra than she took from Elizabeth, because in particular, she was quite jealous of her luxury apartment, her maid, her lifestyle, and her social status. Again, wanting power and mm-hmm. stature in the community was a huge motivator for Jane.
All she got from Elizabeth was a watch.
Exactly. She had begun to get like really bored, sort of the whole nursing grind, because all of her life has been in servitude, right? When she was a kid, you know, she was being abused. She was a servant all through growing up. And even as a nurse, you know, you're serving others, yes. which like we all do that because it's a very honorable job. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we all know that. But for her, she just feels like a servant still. And, you know, even though she has a great reputation in the community, you know, top doctors in the city of Boston are all endorsing her and she's a well-respected nurse. She's still living that life. Exactly. It's not enough. She's still living that life of service. She wants luxury. She wants opulence. She wants servants of her own. And she wants to be on the other side for once. And she doesn't have that. So on February 11th, 1900.
Oh, that's a good day.
Happy birthday, Devon. On February 11th of 1900, she poisoned her, Myra, with strychnine as well, killing her. Now, following her death, Jane went to the dean of the school that Myra was the dining matron of.
Said, give me her job.
Basically, she spun this whole crazy take about how Myra had told her that as one of her dying wishes that she wanted Jane to take over her position as the dining matron.
Yeah, because you can do that.
Which, like, how did this even happen? Because she's not qualified. But somehow they accepted this as, like, enough to employ this woman
it's
as
my
the
dying wish
matron.
That you become president of the United States. So,
done.
There. Now it has to happen.
Now it is written in stone. Yes. It's happening. So, like, it's kind of wild that this happened, but somehow they accepted her. Jane moved into this gorgeous apartment. She had her maid. Of course, this did not last too long.
She killed the maid.
No. Okay. Might as well have.
Sorry.
Might as well have. So, unfortunately, Jane was, of course, very poorly prepared for this role. She had never been
in... She probably thought it was easy.
She probably did. She thought that it was all just about, like, glamour. The luxury and the glamour when, like, no, actually, you have a shitload of responsibility.
You have to work.
It comes with a lot of, like, administrative duties. And so she was responsible for managing, like, the whole dining budget. She was managing staff. She was supervising people. She was responsible for, like, payroll of these people. And managing a really, really tight schedule. I mean, it was like a lot. I mean, you were like managing this whole department of a school. So she found that particularly the finances were challenging for her, mainly because she had never had much to her own self for money.
So she didn't know how to manage it.
Exactly. And she was well known for, you know, she would get money and then spend it immediately. So she didn't really ever save anything. Right. She kind of, it burned a hole in her pocket.
Bad habits with money.
Yes, it does. So she was never really good with money. Now, eventually, grievances started rolling in from the staff about their unpaid wages and the schedule confusion, and her competence was called into question. This prompted this whole internal investigation, and she was suspected of larceny eventually. Like, she was actually taking money from the department.
You can't do that.
No. Eventually, people do find out about that, too, Jane.
Frowned upon.
General, yes. So, And you know, she obviously denied these allegations, but she was eventually relieved of her duties and asked to move out of her luxury apartment.
Homeless.
Womp womp. So, of note, she had rented that summer home in Catawmet that her sister-in-law in, her and Elizabeth vacationed there.
Okay.
So she had rented that home on several occasions. And
yeah, because I'd want to go back to the place that I killed a family member in.
Totally.
Why not?
But she loves that. Like, she does literally love basking in all that because she's messed crazy. Up. Yeah.
Yeah.
So apparently she had gotten into some hot water, though, because she had rented that cottage several times and was not paying a lot of her rent there.
You can't do that.
Devin's really good at whispering, you can't.
People get mad.
They do get mad. Eventually, they do get mad. Now, she had then moved on from Catawmet to the residence of Melvin and Eliza Beadle, who lived in Cambridge. They had an extra room that they were renting, so they put an ad in the paper, and she called them up.
Here comes Jolly Jane.
Here comes Jolly Jane. So, meanwhile, she had a good relationship with the Beadle family, but the landlords of that Catawmet home were banging down the door trying to collect all of her back rent. So this is where we are going to meet the Davis family. Now, the Davis family is a wealthy family from the Catawmet area, and they owned many rental properties in the area, including the one that Jane was renting and had owed back rent on. Now, the family was sort of headed up by Alden Davis, who was sort of the patriarch of the family. He didn't really care too much about that back rent. They had plenty of money. But Alden's wife, Mary Davis, who went by Maddie, was determined to collect the rent because for her, it was upwards of $500, which back then was quite a bit of money, you know. So despite the issue with the rent, Jane and the Davis family actually did know each other well and were close because that summer home was very, very close to the Davis estate. Okay. And so they kind of knew each other well. Jane helped them out from time to time. And so that's why Alden Davis was like, just, you know, leave her alone, let it slide. But Mary was
Did they bond over the fact that her sister died in their home?
I don't know. That's a good question. Yeah. So That's the thing here is that, you know, Jane was really, really good at just, like, getting on the good side of everybody. Like, you know, it doesn't matter how bad she's fucking people over. Somehow, nobody ever suspected Jane because she was so sweet and so nice.
Yeah.
And she was just so good at hiding all of that, you know? Now, the year is now 1901. It's June 25th, 1901. Maddie embarks on a journey from Catawmet for Cambridge to hunt Jane down and collect that back rent.
I'm coming for my $500.
I love you, but give me the $500. Mm-hmm. Now, unfortunately, when Maddie was leaving, she was actually like chasing down the train and she tripped and fell and she like injured her leg or her ankle or something. Aww. It wasn't a like hugely bad injury. Actually, later on, Maddie was quoted to have said, quote, "I only really bruised my ego," end quote. But she was like an older lady. I do that
all the time.
She was like an older lady. So, you know, when you have a little trouble getting around, you know, to begin with, you know, that can kind of lay you up for a little while. It wasn't real serious. She didn't break anything. It was just enough that she was like, she got on the train. She continued her journey, but she was like sore, you know? Mm-hmm. So Maddie Davis arrives at the Beetle residence, which is where Jane is renting a room. She is seeking out Jane for that back rent, and Maddie, being kind of sore, being exhausted from the journey, appreciated Jane's offer to come inside, take a load off, rest, because the two did know each other. You know, it wasn't super hostile. She's like, "Give me my money. I love you, but can I have my money?" So Jane said, "Listen, before we go to the bank, let's just relax. Let's go inside, put your feet up." And, you know, Maddie's like, "All right, I'm old, I'm sore, I'm tired. Like, this is fine. I am going to come in and relax." So Jane, of course, takes the opportunity to immediately offer her a glass of Hunyadi mineral water. Which is that? That's that stuff that is the bitter mineral water.
Yeah.
And Jane later admits that this was laced with morphine.
I was going to say, what was in it?
Yeah. Jane stated that after her drink, she assured Maddie that she had the money and that they could go to the bank together. So Jane recalled at this point that as the two departed, they were starting to walk out. Maddie began losing her balance and reported feeling very lightheaded and woozy. She initially attributed it to just her fall and her exhaustion from traveling, but she pressed on, and with each step, she grew weaker and weaker until she finally collapsed. And then Jane kind of picked her up, carried her back to the apartment, put her down on the couch, administered her another glass of this mineral water, additional morphine included. And this set off just this chilling series of efforts from Jane to decimate the entire Davis family. No.
So she started with the wife.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
So this is kind of a interesting and convoluted tale, and I'm going to try and be as clear as I can because there's a lot of people involved here.
Uh-oh.
And so there's a lot of family members here, each with their own sort of story, one by one. And so I hope that you guys can follow me because it's kind of complicated. It's not that bad.
I didn't have coffee, remember.
Devin, I think you'll be able to keep up.
Okay.
Okay. So Jane, being close to the Davis family, is the one that calls and notifies the Davis family of Maddie's sudden illness and that she's with me in the Beetle residence here, and she's not doing well. Someone's got to come check her out because she's not doing well.
The husband wasn't suspicious?
No. Why would he be suspicious?
Well, I mean, she went there for money. She went there to go get money from her.
But they know her, and like, Jane's this respected nurse. You know, and Maddie's kind of elderly. Like, it's plausible that she could be really, like, banged up from the journey. I don't know. So her daughter Genevieve, which I love that name too. Me and names, man. Her daughter Genevieve arrives with a physician by the name of Dr. John Nichols to come and check her out. And Jane made up this whole story about Maddie's illness. She said that Maddie, who was a diabetic, consumed a huge piece of cake, which caused her sugar to spike. And Jane even went so far as to provide a urine sample, which she had altered to contain large amounts of sugar, which was how they diagnosed diabetes back in the day.
Okay. Wow. Okay. Yeah. So how did she alter it?
She literally probably put some sugar in a cup of pee.
Okay. So with that literal. Okay.
I literally, what else would she do?
Was it her pee? Is the pee irrelevant?
Devin, the pee is irrelevant. The pee is a minute detail here. While we're here in the midst of spooky season, it's the best time to talk about another wonderful podcast that I've really been listening to a lot lately, and that's called Southern Gothic.
Now, this is a scripted single narrator podcast featuring an immersive sound design. It's really such a vibe to listen to this. It really puts you into the story that you're listening to. It's really incredible what they can do. It explores Southern stories from the intersection of history, true crime, and folklore. In addition, they were a finalist of Paranormality Magazine's Best Ghost Stories podcast 2 years running in 2021 and 2022, which is super cool. Southern Gothic is produced by siblings Brianne and Brandon Schexeneider. Now, Brandon takes pride in participating in the great Southern tradition of storytelling while using his professional talents as an audio engineer to take listeners truly drawing them in. And Brianne provides extensive research for each episode. Some of the reviews include, quote, a podcast that comes alive, the use of sound is superb, and editing is incredible, end quote. And I can personally attest to that first one. Another one is, quote, why wasn't history class this interesting? Brandon thoroughly researches in depth and breadth his topics. Dramatic professional presentation with top-notch music. We want more and more, end quote. Some popular episodes include everything from America's most infamous hauntings to unknown local tales that have never been heard outside their primary region. Including the mystery of the Confederate submarine H.L. Huntley, the birth of a city, New Orleans, the Greenbrier Ghost, which I've listened to that one. It is incredible. It really draws you in, as well as the ghosts of Myrtle's Plantation. Search Southern Gothic wherever you get your podcasts and hit subscribe today. So, now that...
So she's got a fake diagnosis as to why she died.
And based on the sugary urine, Dr. Nichols agreed and diagnosed her with a diabetic coma. Now, you can go into a diabetic coma with very, very, very high blood sugars. And diabetic coma is a term used to describe like a loss of consciousness related to dangerously high blood glucose.
Or low.
Right. And it can lead, dangerously high sugar levels can lead to DKA, which is what kills people with diabetes. Yeah. You know, it becomes a very life-threatening acid-base imbalance within the body, which results in profound hypovolemia.
There she goes again.
There I go. Sorry, sorry.
No, I love it.
Reel it in. Reeling it in. So, using this diagnosis, over the course of 7 days, Jane continued to poison Maddie with atropine and morphine, creating a wide range of effects, effectively toying with her life and taking her sweet time doing so, right under the supervision of Maddie's daughter Genevieve and Dr. Nichols. And Jane reported that she took much delight in nursing Maddie back to health for brief periods and then redosing her and driving her back into a coma over and over and over again.
Oh, my word.
So she tortured the shit out of this woman.
And oh, my gosh.
She finally died on July 2nd, 1901.
Oh.
Now, after Maddie's... That's awful. Isn't it terrible?
Wow.
Now, after Maddie's death, Genevieve...
She's getting some kind of sick pleasure out of this. 100%. Because if you just wanted to kill her, then kill her.
Oh, she would have done it. She absolutely was capable of just giving her a shitload of morphine and ending it in minutes. Mm-hmm. And that's not what she wanted. So, after Maddie's death, Genevieve went back to Katomet to make funeral arrangements. Jane followed and joined them back in Katomet, watching over Maddie's remains on the way back. She said, I'll take the remains, you know, I'll go separately, but I'll be behind you. So they all get back to that Katomet home, and now the family, so the family consists of Alden, who was Maddie's husband, of course, Maddie, who had just passed, leaving her husband Alden, now widowed, the couple, or widowered, right? Widowered?
Widowed.
Yeah, that. Then the couple had two daughters. Genevieve was the eldest, and her younger sister was Minnie. And they had actually moved into the estate following Maddie's death, despite having families and children of their own to watch over their elderly father during this difficult time. And the Davises had invited Jane to move into their home for the summer and assist them with caring for Alden. No. Because, again, he's like an older, frail guy.
No.
I know. He was needing occasional help, but otherwise was very healthy. He was still getting around. Now, Jane, of course, played the role of a caring friend and nurse so convincingly well.
I'm sure.
And all the while, she was plotting whom to kill next and how she would get away with it. She was truly evil, honestly. No one ever expected or suspected her until the very end. So interestingly, about a week after she moved in, Jane seemed to develop a new fascination with starting fires.
She became an arsonist all of a sudden?
Very random. And I will say that pyromania and arson is actually a very common among people who suffer from antisocial personality disorder. It's really? A thing. Absolutely. Huh. And that's what I suspect is going on here. A week after Maddie's death, the parlor of the Davis's home catches fire.
Mysteriously, because as if this family hasn't been through enough.
Yeah, exactly. And so, of course, Jane is the first to respond to Alden's cries for help.
Shocker.
And helps immediately to put out the fire. Subsequently, the home catches fire several more times over the next couple of weeks.
What?
The family was obviously terrified and thought there was, an arsonist that was out to get them and trying to kill them for, political reasons or
her name's what Jolly have you. Jane.
Yeah, exactly. In all reality, it was Jane, and I think she genuinely just enjoyed creating utter chaos and terror for her victims. And it made her feel like she just had absolute dominion over people, you know? Like I can really fuck up these people's worlds and they have no idea it's me, and that makes me feel like I'm on the top of the world.
Wow.
This lady's one of the worst people ever. Now, Minnie Gibbs, who is the younger of the two Davis girls, her married name is Gibbs, was 39 at the time. And Minnie was actually a nurse as well. And she noticed some changes in her sister Genevieve, who took the loss of their mom particularly hard, as to be, that's understandable. She was pretty concerned about her mood changes. Pretty soon after her mother died, Genevieve falls ill. So Genevieve, of course, followed Jane's orders and took medicines and mineral water from her. And she quickly grew worse and died on July 26, 1901.
Wait, she took these from Jane?
From Jane, because as soon as she fell ill, Jane rushed right to her side and said, "I'll save you."
So she naturally started to fall ill?
No.
Then I missed something.
Jane poisoned her.
Yeah, well, I'm getting that, but I missed the start of it. Okay.
So there wasn't really a start other than suddenly Genevieve falls ill, which was meant to imply that Jane started poisoning her, and as soon as she got sick from it, Jane sucked herself right to the bedside and kept doing it. So she, of course, grew worse very quickly and died on July 26, 1901. So now within 1 month,
that's six weeks from the mother.
It was 1 month. Within 1 month, Alden, the patriarch of the family, had buried his wife and his daughter.
Oh my God.
So he was obviously very distraught now.
So now it's just Alden and Minnie.
Yep. Now the, family doctor attributed, Genevieve's death to heart disease.
How'd he come to that one?
Well, we'll talk a little bit about it, but I mean, these are just guesses when someone dies mysteriously in this era.
Yeah.
Alden obviously is very distraught. Now, he had been doing a lot of work to their house and stressing out about getting some of the damage repaired from the fires. He had traveled into Boston trying to find contractors to do this work. He was pretty worn out. On August 8th, this is a few weeks after the death of his daughter, Jane nonchalantly offers him a glass of Hunyadi mineral water. And on August 9th, Alden died.
Oh.
This was 2 weeks after the death of his daughter.
Okay.
And about 6 weeks after the death of his wife.
She's not wasting any time.
No. The doctors attributed...
And then in the middle of all of these deaths, the house just keeps catching on fire.
Yeah. Yep.
How's Minnie?
We'll get to Minnie. The doctors attributed Alden's death to a cerebral hemorrhage, which is a sudden brain bleed that can be immediately fatal. It's worth noting that many of these diagnoses at the time are made clinically because, of course, without
imaging
and,
yeah,
and blood tests that we have now, it would be nearly impossible to pinpoint and confirm mm-hmm. a brain bleed or heart disease or focal peritonitis or any of this stuff right. that is being diagnosed. Basically, clinicians back then would make their best guesses based on the patient's age, their history, their constellation of symptoms, and then like the cascade of events that led to yeah. their death. So do they know that it was a brain bleed? No, but that's their best guess based on the tools that they right. have.
Nobody even at this point decided that three family members within 6-7 weeks of each other, all of natural causes, wasn't oh,
someone's
a thing.
Someone's very suspicious. We're going to get to someone? That. We're going to get to that. Yeah. Someone we don't know yet. After Alden's funeral, Minnie is the only one of the Davis family left. Now, Minnie was invited shortly after this to visit a friend, along with Jane, to sort of lift her spirits because all of her family nearly They're had gone. Passed, right? So Jane offers her some cocoa wine, which was a popular drink back in the day.
Does she make these names up? I'm just asking.
No, this was a popular drink okay. back in the day that was marketed as another like energy booster. It was like the Rockstar energy drink of back in the day. But it was like a, you know,
I need some right now.
Yeah, I know. God, me too. So the cocoa wine, of course, was laced with morphine. Minnie collapsed prior to leaving for this little trip. Jane, of course, was quick to jump to her side and quote unquote nurse her back to health. But what she actually ended up doing was giving Minnie some more Hunyadi mineral water, which Jane then later admitted contained atropine and morphine. She also claims she injected her with a syringe full of morphine. Minnie worsened over the coming 36 hours, and the family's doctor, whose name was Dr. Ladder, by the way, was thinking, you know, she was just worn out from all the recent events and all of the unexpected deaths in her family.
Come on, Doc.
Everyone trusted him. He had been present with all of the family members were ill, and after they had died, he had examined their bodies. So Dr. Ladder instructed Jane to continue offering her mineral water and cocoa wine in hopes that she would improve. This, of course, just gave Jane the opportunity to continue playing yo-yo with her mm-hmm. hemodynamics like she was with everybody else. Eventually, Minnie reached the point of being completely comatose. Now, at this point, Jane is unable to force her to ingest more drugs because it was just coming out of her mouth and she wouldn't swallow it. Trigger warning here because we're going to get into something kind of invasive and sort of sexual assault type theme. Jane resorted then to concocting an enema out of water, whiskey, and massive doses of morphine and administered it directly to her.
Oh my fuck. Jeez.
Medications like alcohol and chemicals administered rectally can be just as potent or even more potent than if given orally, because they're absorbed by that so mucosa just right into the bloodstream just as effectively as if they were ingested into the stomach. So it did essentially the same thing, be administered mm-hmm. that way. So Dr. Ladder was pretty stupefied when Minnie continued to get worse and worse with no great explanation. And so he had a colleague named Dr. Alfred Studner come and evaluate her for just like a second opinion and to see if there's something else that we could do.
Is this the guy?
No.
Damn it.
He thought, you know, her sister just died of her sister, Genevieve, mm-hmm. just died of heart disease. Mm-hmm. What if we give her some digitalis and nitroglycerin to see if that cures her ailments? So digitalis, we've actually talked about before, mm-hmm. but it's derived from the foxglove plant. It's actually marketed as digoxin now. Mm-hmm. It's still used today. Cardiac glycoside, it's given to treat arrhythmias and heart failure. And then nitroglycerin is a nitrate, which is given to dilate blood vessels and is commonly used in episodes of chest pain that are caused by narrow coronary arteries. And in combination, these two could boost the cardiac function. So it actually does make a lot of sense that they would order these in combination. Unfortunately, though, Minnie died despite their efforts on August 13th, presumed by Dr. Ladder to have died of exhaustion.
Sure.
Yeah. Sure.
Not liking these lame diagnoses. Well, I know that they don't
have
any.
That's all they have.
Exactly. I know that they don't. You didn't let me finish. I know that they don't have diagnostic techniques like they do now at their disposal. Mm-hmm. I'm just disappointed.
I know. I'm sorry, Mama.
Now, thanks, Mama.
Let's meet 70-year-old Paul Gibbs. Paul Gibbs is Minnie Gibbs's father-in-law. So he is the father of Minnie's husband. We are going to meet him because he's pretty badass. And he's like...
Oh, this is the guy.
This is the guy.
This is the guy. So, I love the when the guys come.
He was quite suspicious of Jane, particularly while Minnie was under Jane's care. Her father-in-law, Paul, witnessed Jane inject Minnie with something, with a syringe. Mm-hmm. And he had asked, what are you giving her? You know, and he didn't ask this to be intrusive because he was suspicious at first. He was expecting she would tell him, the doctor told me to give this medication to try and help her. But he was very thrown off by her reaction to the question. She got, he later recounted that he was very unsettled, like, immediately because she was visibly anxious. And she was obviously shocked and, very disappointed that he had seen her do this. Mm-hmm. Like, she was trying to hide it. Mm-hmm. And when trying to explain what she was doing, she told him two completely different things, one right after the other, as if she was, like, actively trying to make something up and was completely unprepared. So he was mm-hmm. like, well, wait a minute. What the fuck are you doing now? I'm very suspicious.
If it was
suspicious.
Legit, it would be consistent.
Yeah, you would be able to tell me if this was legit. So, Harry Gordon, who's Minnie's brother-in-law. Now, this is Genevieve's husband, who just lost her sister Genevieve.
Okay.
Minnie's brother-in-law also noticed that Minnie recoiled any time that Jane approached her with water or medications or anything. Almost as if
like
Jane,
this, like a getaway
like,
from me.
Like she couldn't quite say, uh-huh. like, listen, this lady's hurting me, but she would like see
so she's
her
like
coming
retracting
and recoil.
Away from her.
Exactly. Yeah. So almost as if she couldn't really say it, but she knew that Jane was doing something to her. So with these two like pieces of information, the two were talking, uh-huh. and Paul got wind of this information, and it occurred to him that Jane could have been hurting Minnie, and what if she was the common denominator, and what if she didn't just do this to Minnie, but to
She's
literally
the only one
in the
house in the still
family.
Alive.
Exactly. And this revelation to him was like obviously earth-shattering. He had no proof at this point. It was right. just a theory. So let's meet Dr. Ira Cushing, who was So Dr. Ira Cushing is a family friend. He wasn't really involved in anyone's care, but he was a good friend of Alden and the rest of the family. Now, he had made a statement later on saying, you know, I ran into Alden like literally the day before he died, and he was fine. And he had actually reached out to the family a couple days later, like after Alden died, and was shocked to hear that Alden had passed suddenly. Mm-hmm. And when he started talking with Paul Gibbs, this guy that was Minnie's father-in-law, he started getting suspicious and started agreeing with Paul's theory that maybe this lady is actually poisoning people. Like, because that makes sense. Why else would all these family members just die mm-hmm. one mm-hmm. right after the other? That makes absolutely no sense. So, he immediately picks up the phone and calls Dr. Latter, who's the family's physician. Unfortunately, this, again, is just conjecture. And right. Dr. Latter was like, you know, that's an interesting theory. Mm-hmm. I have no reason to suspect that Jane's been doing this other than the fact that these four people are now dead, right. mysteriously.
He's never had his own suspicions of anything
exactly.
foul.
And again, there's no proof. So they're just trying to figure out, like, how can we start an investigation into this and try to figure out if there's proof? So Paul Gibbs is actually a naval captain. Ooh. And he's like kind of a big deal. He was a huge badass and he was not giving up and he wanted justice for his daughter-in-law and her family. Mm. And so he had tons of connections because he was a respected member of the community. And so he enlisted the help of the DA at the time in the county. and also of a toxicology professor from Harvard University named Dr. Edward Wood. And immediately a case was opened. And they were like, this is super suspicious. We can't ignore this. So the DA was Lemuel Holmes, and he ordered the bodies of Genevieve and Minnie to be exhumed for testing. And immediately had a top detective start tailing Jane wherever she went, unbeknownst to Jane. So Jane has no idea, right?
I love She's this being part. Followed. I'm loving it.
So while the bodies are being exhumed and tested and we're waiting for toxicology to come back, Jane leaves for the Toppin family estate back in Lowell, where she grew up as an indentured servant. So, again, I'm sorry if this is getting convoluted. There's a lot of people. There's a lot of moving parts.
I'm totally following along.
Great. Perfect. I'm glad to hear that.
She's back, like, where she grew up, essentially.
Exactly. So, she had traveled there because, get this, she knows, so she's like, I have no way into the Davis family anymore because I've essentially killed everybody. So I'm going to go back to my old home and I'm going to find R.M.L. Brigham, who was the husband of the stepsister that she murdered, Elizabeth Toppin, and marry him.
What?
And then kill him. So that I can finally live in luxury like
and have
I want
his estate.
To. Because I want to be a deacon's wife and I want to live in luxury and I want to have his estate and all of their money. So she has this crazy plan. She wanted to make RML begin to love her and then slowly poison him so that she could care for him and convince him to leave her everything, including the estate that he inherited from Elizabeth, so that it could all be Jane's. This woman just wanted the fucking world.
Just give it to me. Give it to me. Give me the fucking kill world. My way to get there.
Yeah, just kill her way to the top. Murder her way up. So, unfortunately for Jane, her plan immediately fell through when RML wanted absolutely nothing to do with her romantically. So...
good for him.
Jane responded to this rejection by literally killing everyone in the city of Lowell that she was pregnant with his baby.
Scandal.
I know. Like, okay. Relax. Relax, lady.
In the 1900s, early 1900s.
What a
fucking
time to be alive.
Wow.
This, of course, was a blatant lie, and when the deacon rebuked these rumors, Jane, again, being the professional gaslighter and narcissist she probably was, and panicking that things were falling apart yet again, made a theatrical attempt at suicide. She ingested mineral water laced with a bunch of morphine, somehow survived, and was subsequently hospitalized for a few days and then discharged. Because, like, obviously they didn't have great mental health resources back then.
Right, other than sending you to some asylum or something.
Right.
But that's to just lock you away, not help you.
Now, the detective continues to tail her, but no proof has been made itself that she has poisoned anybody. So she gets out of the hospital, and she next travels to Amherst, New Hampshire.
Ooh.
To stay with a friend of hers, Sarah Nichols. And while she was in Amherst recovering from her whole ordeal, meanwhile, toxicology results have returned from Minnie Gibbs and Genevieve Gordon's testing.
And?
Both were found to have lethal doses of arsenic in their system.
Wah, wah, wah.
The blood thickens.
Bring it on.
So... arsenic, just so everybody knows, is a naturally occurring element in minerals in the earth and even trace elements in our water and in some foods we eat. Trace organic arsenic is typically harmless and is not really in, as long as it's not in, like, detectable amounts.
Right.
Poisoning can occur with injection or inhalation of massive amounts of organic or inorganic arsenic, which acts by disrupting ATP synthesis, which is a cellular process for energy transfer. And it's essentially like a very critical part of almost every body function. Basically, it results in widespread cell death and organ failure. It can lead to nausea, abdominal pain, headaches,
awful,
nerve pain, ataxia, diarrhea, dehydration, hypotension, and it also leads to QT prolongation, which is a lengthening of an interval within the electrical activity in the heart, which then can give you a lethal arrhythmia and kill you.
So cardiac changes.
Yes.
That we would now see on your EKG, but you're not going to see it back on your 1900s.
Then. Exactly. So arsenic is also a popular poison because it is tasteless and odorless.
And you can slip it in whatever.
Easy to use. Now, with this information, on October 29th, 1901, Jane was arrested at her friend's home in Amherst, New Hampshire, for murder of Minnie Gibbs and Genevieve Gordon. Now, Jane immediately is locked up in Barnstable County Jail, and she knew that the prosecution had no case because Jane never used arsenic to poison anyone.
Dun, dun, dun. Well, I mean, that's true, because you never said it until now.
That's right.
But, what the fuck?
We'll get there. There's an explanation.
This is reminding me of, like, the time when I was creeped out why I couldn't figure out that guy's DNA didn't match. Remember?
I know. I told you the plot thickens, dude. So, around this time, Dr. Latter, who was the family physician and someone who would be a key witness in Jane's whole prosecution, passes away.
No.
Which wasn't Jane's fault, but it was shitty timing because he would have really helped, this whole prosecution case.
Yeah. We needed him.
Now, with no one to really corroborate the story, once again, they were left with no real connection or proof, and it was all just conjecture. So she hires her childhood friend to be her lawyer, James Murphy. And here's the thing. Back in Victorian era, arsenic was in everything. It was in makeup, it was in house paint, clothing, dishware, and many people were unaware of how deadly it was, and it was used pretty routinely.
Okay.
The prosecution had only the dead bodies who tested positive for arsenic, and in order to get a conviction, prosecutors would really need to connect Jane with large amounts of arsenic somehow to prove that she gave them enough arsenic to kill them. So they ended up going door to door to pharmacies trying to find somebody who remembered selling Jane large quantities of arsenic. They came up completely empty handed. She had never bought any arsenic.
Right.
So in addition, the undertaker came forward. The undertaker who prepared both Minnie and Genevieve's bodies revealed that arsenic is the main ingredient in his embalming fluid.
Oh.
So there goes their case.
So this is falling apart.
It's really falling apart. So Jane is feeling really good right now.
Fuck her.
Because she's like, I mean, this really fucked over the prosecution's case for a minute there. So the fact that, large quantities of arsenic was present in their bodies was all of a sudden not entirely surprising. And this was devastating for the prosecution's case. So they knew they needed to keep digging, and they needed to find a way to prove that Jane did something, because it was very clear that she did. Now, the DA, the toxicologist, they all knew Jane was poisoning people. So this prompted a whole nother inquest, and the bodies of Minnie and Genevieve were re-exhumed and re-examined in an effort to find more proof.
Wow.
So they underwent additional toxicology testing, this time testing specifically for other compounds that were not included on the initial testing. They tested for morphine and atropine this time.
Good.
As well as other chemicals. And both bodies tested positive for large quantities of morphine and atropine.
Now we got her.
Now we're getting somewhere.
Now we got her.
So basic toxicology testing, like I said, didn't include these compounds. Now, nowadays, toxicology testing is very comprehensive, and they use multiple different tissue samples, like the liver, the hair, the kidneys, nerve fibers. They can do all sorts
everything.
Of crazy shit.
Everything.
So, they were able to connect this directly to Jane, because they went and did their due diligence with the pharmacists again. And they were talking to all the pharmacists in the area. And finally, they found a pharmacist that said, absolutely, she was in here buying massive amounts of both those medications.
Wow.
So that was the nail in the coffin. They finally had a witness.
They had a connection to what she did.
Exactly right. She was indicted for the murders of Alden, Genevieve, and Minnie. And in January of 1902, Jane's defense decided to
have... But not the mother?
No.
Hmm.
I know. And it may have been that, you know, exhuming that body and connecting her to that would have just done been additional cost when they could convict her on the three murders and put her away forever.
Got it.
I think that was maybe part of their thought process, but I can't be sure. So, January of 1902, Jane's defense decides to have her mental health examined. She was evaluated by a team of psychiatrists in her cell, and she had maintained her innocence initially and seemed determined to clear her name, but then as they pushed further, over some more time, she began confessing to poisoning at least 11 additional people. Whoa. And the team were very shocked at her coldness and her flatness as she described these killings and what she did to her victims. And by the end of March, she was officially deemed, quote, insane. And this was an official term used back in the day. I'm not meant to, you know, offend anybody, but it meant that she was not competent to stand trial mm-hmm. at the time. Now, June 23rd of 1902, 45-year-old Jane Taupin was found not guilty by reason of insanity.
Oh, okay.
And she was sentenced to lifetime at Taunton State Hospital.
Okay.
So, the following day, she was sent back to her new home at Taunton. And actually, she told her lawyer she was stoked about the sentence because she didn't think it could have gone better. She had heard that murderers sent to psychiatric wards could eventually be deemed fit to reenter society after some time.
Does that not mean they're refit to... be tried in your case?
Well, I don't know how that rule went, because I know that's how it is now. We talked about that with Howard Schneider.
Yeah, we did.
But I don't know how that was back in the day. But there have been murderers that back in that time had actually gotten out and re-entered society.
So at this point, she's a Taunton thinking she's going to get out.
Thinking she's just going to manipulate her way out of this situation and end up a free woman again. She did not count on her defense team divulging to her psychiatry caregivers that she confessed to them to committing at least 31 total murders that she knew of, and that the total number could have been over 100.
Oh.
She was quoted to have said the following very chilling few phrases. No. Quote, "I have never felt sorry for what I have done. Even when I poisoned my dearest friends, I have never felt any regret." End quote.
Well, I hope you sit there and rot.
Yeah, exactly.
Did she?
We'll get to that.
Oh, boy.
So,
oh.
The three psychiatrists who were assigned to her care during her stay at Taunton eventually declared her a, quote, psychopath, which essentially confirms my suspicions that she had what is now known as antisocial personality disorder, because that's what that sort of more archaic term means.
Right,
right. Trigger warning, some sexual assault and abuse vibes to follow. She did go on to discuss her motivations with her psychiatry team. These included theft. She also admitted that she got a profound sexual thrill from each and every murder, and that she did molest several of her victims. By killing and taking everything she could from them, she felt this sense of power that was like a drug to her. And she said that was the thing that got her up in the mornings at times. In the following years, her mental status deteriorated sharply. She developed what was felt to be early onset dementia, and she became combative, suspicious, and confused. In a very bizarre sort of twist of fate, and which is very ironic, Jane started vocalizing that she felt like the nurses were poisoning her.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
Oh, so sad for her.
She became afraid to eat and drink, and she needed to be force-fed against her will.
Good. And I would never approve of that, but yep, good.
Good. This is the lady that deserves that, 100%. She remained at Taunton for the rest of her days, and she died... a pretty old woman in August 17th of 1938.
Bye-bye.
And that is the story of Jolly Jane.
She did not get her release.
Nope.
Too bad. So sad.
Yep.
Wow. She is messed up.
So fucked up. Am I right?
Yeah.
I wanted to mention this book that I read. I got a lot of awesome information from it. So it's called Fatal, The Poisonous Life of a Female Serial Killer. It's by Harold Schechter. And it is an incredibly detailed examination into Jane's life. It has a lot more interviews with her and a lot more of the things she said about her motivations and some statements from her psychiatry team. And it's really fascinating. So if you want to know more detail about this, I highly, highly recommend Fatal, The Poisonous Life of a Female Serial Killer by Harold Schechter. And I will link that in the show notes.
This was a good one, Kate.
Wasn't it? What a wild tale.
Mm-hmm.
I hope it had that.
Twists and turns.
It was very twisty in the end where there was like a lot of people. So I hope it was followable.
I got it. Okay. I had it all down.
Great. Awesome.
Thank you, everyone, for listening.
Y'all are the best.
If you want to keep checking us out, you can find us on Instagram at MedCrimes Podcast.
Tweet at us at MedCrimes PC once Twitter comes back to life. I don't know when that's going
to
be.
It needs to be exhumed. Search us on Facebook at MedCrimes Podcast.
If you wish to become a Patreon, visit www.patreon.com/MedCrimes Podcast.
If you have any crazy stories, you can check us out. Send us anything you want at MedCrimes@gmail.com.
We are crazy about you guys. We love all the feedback we get, the good and bad. We take it all very seriously. We are still working on the little things with our audio and such, and we're always working to improve, so we hope you guys stick with us.
Please do.
We love ya.
Thanks for listening.
Stay safe out there.